Today's Yom Yerushalayim, and we're gonna. I have a thought that I'm going to develop in Yom Yerushalayim based on the following question. Every year, like we were talking about this, Yom Yerushalayim comes and goes, and it's like, but the kids like to go, and they have a fun time and they dance. But especially as it came to the 50th year of Yom Yerushalayim, it's like you want to understand like what is the meaning of this chag, like how should we relate to it? So I've thought about it quite a bit. I've been reading quite a bit. I brought you like my reading material. I haven't finished with this thing. It's like impossible to get through. Mukuri Shom put out this like, it's like a mini book. It's like crazy. It's a magazine length essay on you know written by this guy Chagai Segal on Yom Yerushalayim, and I've been trying to read 1967, which is almost impossible to get through. Don't read it. It's very, very dry. But I'm trying to get through and understand what is this Yom Yerushalayim, like, because if you think about it, like. We speak about Yerushalayim, and was everybody here at the event on Monday? Yeah. Oh, you missed it. Okay. It was nice. It was lovely. But it's like, it was nice and it was lovely. Everybody understand what I'm saying? And you go to the Kotel and you try to feel a connection. And obviously, it's the most holy city. But there's got to be more to it than that. You know, we make a lot of it, but there has to be more to it than that. I believe that there really, really is. Yeah.
Nothing.
Okay. You had this like. You sometimes like take a deep breath when you're ready to say something. Okay, very good. Thank you. And so I want to develop this idea, this thought, based on the Chag of Shvi'i Shel Pesach, on the seventh day of Pesach, because we have to understand what is the seventh day of Pesach. And I'll give the punchline right before, and then we'll develop the theme. Hopefully we'll go through like a lot of Tanakh. And I found this really cool shiur on the internet that was unsigned on the Amit website. I don't know, but it was really excellent, an excellent development of Shvi'i Shel Pesach that we're going to go through. And using the idea of Shvi'i Shel Pesach, I would like to suggest that Yom Yerushalayim is actually the end of Yom Ha'atzma'ut. That we don't really, really understand or realize. And through my reading, I've come to believe just how true this is, that and I'm going to hopefully show you that there's a theme in Ramban called Maaseh Avot Siman Libanim that we've discussed over and over again, that what happened to the forefathers, that's a sign for the children, and that history really repeats itself, and that as we're going to hopefully develop in Mitzrayim in the Shvi'i Shel Pesach, that while we got our independence on Yom Ha'atzma'ut in 1948. Right. The Jewish state didn't really, take hold or take root or become a permanent reality until 1967. Right. And the more I read about this and the more we think about it, like we're looking back and we don't really, I was born after 1967, so it's difficult for us to understand. But when you read the histories and the accounts of the way people related to the state, right. They really didn't know if the state was going to survive. It was very much, as I, you're our only witness. Like, it was very much, very much in doubt. Like, so this second book. What's that? So you remember it. So the line that always gets me, he quotes, I don't know if I have the whole thing, but he said, he quotes as like a joke, that, like a very well-known joke that you've all heard of. What? Right, some guy wrote a book and he said like there was a sign in Ben Gurion in his jokes about Levi Eshkol, because there was also, don't forget, there was also an economic depression. It was like Israel economically was doing terribly, and like so the jokes about Levi Eshkol was there's a sign in Ben Gurion airport that said the last one to leave, please make sure you turn off the lights. You've all heard that joke, but what? Really? Okay. So, that gives you a sense, we don't really realize today how much this dialogue has changed. Rav Shtul spoke last night. Rav Shtul, who lives, he's my neighbor, he spoke, he was actually in Givat HaTachmoshed when they captured it. He was fighting, he was at Tzankan in the 67 war. So he told about his experiences. He said, we don't realize is the way that the Egyptians spoke, the way that the Arabs, the countries surrounding us spoke, They didn't hide anything. There was no the most radical Hamas terrorists speak today, and everybody else civilized. But Nasser would get up in his foreign minister got up in the United Nations and said, we fully intend to destroy Israel, to wipe it off the map, please make sure you have your suitcases ready because there's not going to be any Israel when we're done with you. Like literally, you know, like 12, less than 20 years after the Shoah, there's no compunction about it. You know what I'm saying? And this is something the Israelis were hearing time and time again. That's A. B, let's not forget also that the country itself, like the country itself was without the Yudan Shomron, whatever your politics are, and my politics are pretty right wing, but whatever your politics are, you have to also remember that we didn't have the Golan, and we didn't have Yudan Shomron. And if, like, I work in Elkanah, and one of the things, like, I work in Elkanah, and my office is, like, at the highest point in the Mikhlala, like, back, you know, the corner, stuck in the corner. You can literally see this, you can see the water from my office on a clear day. Remember? Right? You can see the water. You can see from Hadera all the way down almost to Ashkelon, literally from my office, meaning that the Jordan held high ground. It held physical high ground. So it wasn't just it was a tactical reality that Israel was incredibly at a disadvantage. Think about on the Kinneret, right, the Yishuvim on the Kinneret, it was a regular occurrence that the Syrians would bomb them. They said about once a month they would shell them while they're trying to farm in the fields. It was a regular occurrence. How do you live like that? And if we think about the way that we live with the specter of terrorism, God forbid, and the fear of terrorism, this isn't terrorism. This is.
We've got the fear of war.
Do you?
It's not constant.
Do you and really you walk around so worried about it?
And not think that your existence is
as having somebody in the army and they're moving his base and they're saying, you know, be ready for the summer. There's going to be more activity this summer.
No, we're hearing the same.
One second. We live here. Army, that's true. With the fear of it. But that all being said,
that's impending. Is fear something impending? It's not the constant fear that is happening now.
It's not existence.
Exactly. It's not existential fear. It's not. I was not, the word that I was thinking about.
There won't be a state tomorrow, but we are worried. We do still have the.
Oh, there are threats. I'm not denying the threats. Mm-hmm. But there's a difference between threats or existential threats. Mm-hmm. And until 1967, Israel really lived under constant existential threat. Right, and that all changed. And the symbol of this to me is Yerushalayim. Right, when you read Segel's book and you read anything about Yerushalayim, yeah. Segel's whatever, his essay, yeah. And anything about Yerushalayim, you realize how much Yerushalayim was a backwater town up until 1967 for a very simple reason. Right, think about they officially moved the government in 1950 or whatever it was. Right, but the whole city, you have to think about the city as a whole. The whole city was cut off literally in half. Right? Why do we go to Yerushalayim? Why does anybody go to Yerushalayim today? Right? You go to, not just the Kotel, you go to archaeology, you go to tourism. So now take away the entire tourism industry from Yerushalayim. So then now you take away from that, you take away hotels, you take away restaurants, you take away the entire economy that surrounds that, you take away all of the Yashvut on the eastern side of the city, and all you have is Beit Vagan and a couple of neighborhoods. How did they populate you? You know how they populated Yerushalayim in the 1950s? Like all the Olim they took from Egypt and Iraq, they put them in these, they built these, you know, slum neighborhoods in order to, because they couldn't get anybody to live there. Because nobody wanted to live there because it was hard to live there. You know, if you think about it, it makes perfect sense. There's no, how do you have a country? Think about a country where its declared capital is in a city that no one wants to go to. Right, that is very symbolic of the country itself. So the, you know, when did they finally build a road, a proper road to get to Yerushalayim? Right now, that's exactly right. they're finally finishing the decent road. They haven't finished it yet, right? They're finally building a train to get to Yerushalayim. Nobody takes a train to Yerushalayim because it's the slow train to China. This is the capital of our country. So if you think about what Yerushalayim represents, Yom Yerushalayim, or the Six-Day War, represents the end of the beginning of the process. Right? It represents a time when Yom HaAtzma'ut finally became true. When we finally became really independent. Independence means I can stand on my own. If you don't think you can stand on your own, you can't stand on your own. And that happened Yom Yerushalayim. That's what I believe. And I'm going to show you, hopefully, in our study of Chumash, that's what happened on Shvi Yishal Pesach exactly the same way. Exactly the same way. When I talk about the Chag of Shvi Yishal Pesach, and from that Chag, I believe that the reason to have the chag, the second chag, is the end of the first chag, and it's pretty obvious from the psukim themselves. Let's look at. One second. Okay, start in Shemot Yudbet Pasuk Yudalid. Shemot Yudbet Pasuk Yudalid. Because the problem is, here we are. Shemot Yudbet Pasuk Yudalid. Moshe Rabbeinu tells the Jewish people that they have to bring the Korban Pesach. Okay? If we think about the Shalosha Regalim, we have Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot, right? The three regalim, the three holidays. Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. Pesach, what's the first day? Why do we have Chag on the first day? That's the day we brought the Korban Pesach. Shavuot, we don't really know, but it's a Chag, one day. Okay? Sukkot, how many days of Chag are there in Sukkot?
Seven.
How many days of Chag? One.
First,
there's only one day. Okay? What's the last day?
Shmini Atzeret.
It's a separate Chag. Atzeret Yalechem's day. Okay? All on Pesach, it's unusual. Pesach is the outlier. Look at V'haya, where am I? Yudalid, right? Yudbet Yudalid. V'haya hayom hazeh lezikaron. V'chagotem oto chag la'ashem ledorotechem. Should be a holiday for you, for your generations. Chukat olam techaguhu. You should eternally celebrate this day. Does it make sense? Why? What are we celebrating on the first day of Pesach? What happened on the first day of Pesach? Right, we went out of Egypt. Okay. But then it says, Shivat yami matzot tochelu. You should eat matzot for 7 days. Ach bayom arishon, tashbitu seor mi batechem. Ki kol ochel chametz, v'nichrata nefesh ayim b'Yisrael, miyom arishon ad yom ha-shavi. It's not one day, it's a week-long holiday. Then, ubayom arishon mikra kodesh, on the first day it's kodesh, ubayom ha-shvi'i mikra kodesh yelechem. And the seventh day is also kodesh, okay, komalacha asher yaseh, ach acher yachel lecho nefesh, hu levado yaseh lechem. The only you're allowed to cook, but the first day is a holiday, and the last day is a holiday.
And you don't say Shekhinah on the last
day. Right. What's the holiday for? What's the last day for?
No more time in the kitchen.
This is the question. What's the last day for? Well, right. But where there is no explicit mention of Kriyat Yam Suf on the last day of Pesach. There's no explicit mention. But the logic dictates, and we're going to see, I think, right? But why would you have a holiday on Kriyat Yam on the seventh day? It's a seven-day holiday, just like Sukkot. There's a seven-day, like the holiday takes on the week, takes on the character of the holiday. Why should there be a Chag on the last day? Even Rina points out something more interesting. It's not a separate Chag. So as opposed to on Shmini Atzeret, where we say Hallel, full Hallel. On Shavuot Pesach, we don't say full Hallel. It's not a new Chag. And like Rina said, we don't say Shechianu on the seventh day. It's not a new Chag. It's an extension of the old Chag. Well, if it's an extension of the old Chag, then why in the world would you make it a Chag? So you understand what I'm trying to bring out here? That on the one hand, it is a holiday, but it's not a new holiday. It's a continuation of the old holiday. So if it's a continuation of the old holiday, how is it? And we're obviously when I raise it, it becomes obvious. Like Rina said, if the idea is that Kriyat Yam Suf is the culmination of the beginning of the process, right? Because if you didn't have Kriyat Yam Suf, then how free would you really be? As we'll soon see. Let's look at. We'll skip from here to the beginning of Parshat Bishalach. Perek Yud Dalet in Shemot. Beginning of Parashat B'Shalach. We'll spend a little time here. Vayhi B'Shalach Paro. Yud Gimel, Pasuk Yud Zayin. They're supposed to be free. Remember, we went free? On the morning of Pesach, we went free? So my question we're going to continue to ask ourselves is, how free were we really? Okay? And once you are, I'm beginning of Parshat B'Shalach. Vayhi B'Shalach Paro. Here we are. Vayhi B'Shalach Paro et ha'am. V'lo nacham Elohim derech eretz plishtim. God didn't lead them derech eretz plishtim. Ki karofu. Despite the fact, we've studied this like a zillion times, it's close. Ki amar Elohim pen yinachem ha'am bi'otam milchama v'shavu mitzrayimah. Because God said, lest they be minachem, lest they regret when they see war, and they'll go back to Egypt. Okay? How much confidence does this fledgling nation have?
Zero.
None. Right. Like the first line of war, go back to Egypt. Vayaso, therefore, Vayasev Elohim et ha'am derech ha'midbar Yamsuf. He took him the way of Yamsuf. V'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim. What does Rashi say chamushim means? Amush, right. Armed. Mizuyanim. One second. Didn't we just say they don't have confidence? So if they don't have confidence, why'd they take their arms? If they're afraid of war, why would they bother taking the swords?
I thought the chamushim applied to the Mitzrim.
No, chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael.
Okay.
Okay. Why would you take weapons if you're afraid of war? What's the answer?
Just in case.
I think the answer is it's like, what?
Defend yourself in case.
Right, but you're going to run back. Meaning, it's not simple. Of course you take steps. Of course you think you're going to. But the question is, of course you take the weapons. But when push comes to shove, do you have the medal? I was talking to Simcha last night, and he's in Tiranut, and this week they're in Latrun. They have classes, and he said today yesterday they were talking about classes about what is it that makes the person go towards the danger as opposed to running away from the danger. That it's very interesting. Like a lot of their training is mental training. Is to be that person. Like it's really weird at the Yom Yerushalayim thing. You know, when you walk out and there's the Shmirah guys that are just sitting there bored, thankfully. For some reason, I thought of that. I thought of exactly that issue. That their job is when there's danger, we're all going to run away, and they're going to run towards. You know, but it takes a mental toughness. It takes a mental attitude to say, there's danger. As I asked the Simcha how he felt about it, and he said, good. This is my role. This is what I'm supposed to do. You know, that's you know, if that's what it needs to be done, then I'm glad that I'm here to do it. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, but a slave can't have that attitude to run towards the danger.
It's about self-preservation. Self-preservation means I protect myself at all costs. I fight or flight.
Usually flight. But the reflex is flight.
Right. Reflex is flight.
And so the military's right up until the Vietnam War, until after the Vietnam War, the role of the officer was to walk up and down behind the men to make sure they didn't run away and to see that they shot.
Sure.
Because the first reflex is fight.
Right. And that's I think fight or flight is also a national attitude. Meaning, do I fight only to defend myself? Right. 67 was the first time where we said, no, we're going to take the fight to them. Why? Because that's what we need to do in order to protect ourselves. It wasn't we're going to wait. A confident country takes the fight to the other side. Right? A fearful country waits until they attack, either politically or diplomatically or economically. You know, so here we have b'chamushim, we take arms. If they attack us, we have to defend ourselves. But push comes to shove, if you don't have that confidence, you're not going to be able to do that anyway. You know, it's mental, it's spiritual, it's all encompassing. It's really interesting. Okay. Vayikach Moshe, we're going to skip Atzmot Yosef. Skip to Chav 4 psukim. Here we go. וידבר שם משה לאמור, דבר אל בני ישראל וישובו ויחנו לפני פי החירות בין מגדול ובין הים, לפני בעל צפון נכחות תחנו על הים. Speak to the children of Israel, and they should return and camp in חירות, between מגדול and the water, before בעל צפון. Let them camp on the water. ואמר פרעה לבני ישראל, נבוכים הם בארץ. And Pharaoh will say to the Jewish people, they are confused, סגר להם על מדבר. They're locked in, they're trapped. I will harden his heart and he will come after you. Okay, and they will all know that I'm God, and you will, and that's what they did. So the king of Egypt was told that they run away.
Although he told them to go.
What?
He kind of told them to go.
He told them to go. Okay.
So how are they running away if he told them to go?
What do you mean? That they ran away?
Like the word barach is a strange.
Well, what were they supposed to do? What was their planned intention?
To go for 3 days.
Go for 3 days. Did anybody believe that they were going to go for 3 days? Not really. No. Okay? Look at Rashi. If you have Rashi, by Yugad Melech Mitzrayim, how was he told? Says Rashi, Ikturin Shalach Imahem. Ikturin? Anybody want to guess what Ikturin is? Spies. He sent spies with them. V'kivan shehigiyu shloshet yamim shekav'u lelech v'lashuv. Right? They got to 3 days distance. They were supposed to come back. V'ra'u she'inam chozrim in the Mitzrayim. And they said they're not coming back. Ba'u behigidu leparo b'yom harvi'i. So that he told them on the fourth day, ubechamishi ubashishi radfu achareihem, and then the fifth day and the sixth day, radfu achareihem, he ran and caught up. Velel shvi'i ardu bayam. Here we have Rashi. What does Rashi say? What happened? The eve of the seventh day, they went into the yam. Bashachrit amru shira. And on the seventh day, in the morning, they said praise to God. V'hu yom shvi'i shel Pesach. And this is the seventh day of Pesach. Lekach anu karim shira b'yom hashvi'i. For this reason, we say Shira, we sing praise on the seventh day. So first thing, what do we see from Rashi? Explicitly, Rashi says, even though there's no mention of this in Sukkim, that the seventh day of Pesach was the day...
The real day
of Kriyat Yamsuf. Right, we take this for granted, by the way. I mean, there's no proof of it, but who knows? There's no... The Torah doesn't say it. The Torah doesn't say how many days they traveled. Right, so we take it for granted. But even more importantly, what was Paro's attitude towards the Jewish people when he sent them away? Or, no, oh, they'll come back, or,
well, they'll die on the journey,
or I'll get them back. Meaning, as long as they're still in his territory, as long as they're still within his military reach, he never really thinks of them as gone. He never really saw the story as over. Right? I sent them away, fine, I sent them away for 3 days. But they're not free. We talk about Pesach as the day when we went free. Did we really go free? Yeah. How free can you be if Paro can send his army to attack and destroy you?
Although when Paro was sent, when they left, there wasn't but please come back in 3 days' time. Like, I got the impression that he said, just go. I don't want to see you anymore.
Yes. No, go worship God. I don't know. Like, well, to us, it's always clear that we're not coming back because we never came back. Was it clear to him? The whole story time, Moshe Rabbeinu says, we just want to go worship our God in the desert. Right, so then we talk about the discussion, why did Moshe Rabbeinu say it in that way when we had no intention of coming back? But we had no intention of coming back. So we talk about...
I didn't think Paro intended it either. Like, he didn't say to them, please come back.
No, he did. He said...
What did he say?
He quotes Moshe and Aaron in the middle of the night, Ve'yomer kumu tzu mitochami. Gamatem gamene Israel, ulechu ibdu et Hashem kidaberchem.
Oh.
Like you said.
Good, right. So I mean, go worship God, and then?
Velechu veberachtem gamoti. He says, gamtumchem gamikarchem kechu kasher divartem.
Right, it's a charade they're all playing. It's a charade they're all playing. Go worship God. Does he think they're going to come back? Does he expect them to come back? No.
Maybe.
Does he? Wait. Does he expect them to come back on their own? But, and when they don't? That's right. Sent the guys to go get them. And it wasn't a big deal. I'll go get them myself.
But there was an aspect they complained about. It wasn't the Slavs and that. And
what do you mean? That's not yet. That's after Kriyat Yamsu. This is all
right,
in the week.
It was always like, oh, we had it better there. It was always like in their minds.
Well, that's the Sidle of Bamidbar. We'll get to that later on in the year. But we're talking about this. We're talking about we're in the week. And I'm saying we always think about Pesach as our freedom. We went free. When did we go free on the night of Pesach? And what I'm trying to just demonstrate to you is not true. Maybe we began to go free on the night of Pesach, but freedom is it a binary thing? It's not yes or no. There are degrees of freedom, right? And can you really say you're free when in fact you're under the control of someone else? And the answer to a large degree is no, you cannot.
I think Miriam's point is well made, that you could even argue that while they were in Egypt, as long as they felt the desire to go back to Mitzrayim, they weren't completely free either. That the freedom.
Well, we're gonna see that. Hold on. Let's go on. Let's read on.
Like Mitzrayim still had a hold on them, so to speak.
Yeah. Let's go on. Okay. So what happens when Mitzrayim comes? What happens when the Egyptians come? So what's the attitudes of the what are the attitudes of the Jewish people? But you got the Melech Mitzrayim. We're right here. Okay, but you got the Melech Mitzrayim. Ki baracha am, vayafoch levav paro v'avadav la'am. They changed their attitude. Vayamru, mazot asinu ki shilachnu et Yisrael mi'avdeinu. What have we done that we sent out the Jews from slavery? Vayasort b'chbo v'damo l'kach imorni. Built up the military. Vayikach shesh me'ot rechev b'chur v'chor rechev Mitzrayim v'shalishim al kulo. And he took all of the military might and the military power that he has. Now, in my mind, when I'm reading this, I want you to keep in mind 1967, this is 1948. So, the nations, the Arabs, they fought us in 1948. Was there a peace agreement in 1948? Did they say, okay, we'll let you be? What's it called?
It was
an armistice. Meaning, they said, we're still going to destroy you, but we don't have time
right now.
Right. We'll figure it out later. Right? You know, we'll re-guard, we'll re-amp up. And this is all happening in the 19 years. You know, there's the Sinai campaign that doesn't go so well, and these countries are building up and getting these Russian weapons and becoming more and more powerful. You know, like, you just have to read the numbers. You know what I'm saying? The numbers don't make any sense. I think it was in the paper. Was it in this week's paper? Or it's in the other room. There's like a chart. Have you seen the charts? You know, the Israeli army versus like the Egyptian army and the Iraqi army. It's like not even close. Like, everybody knew it wasn't even close. Like, they had many more tanks. And if you think about it, you also, like, what kind of planes did we have? Anybody know? We had French Mirages. Okay.
Old.
What?
Old planes.
Well, they were jets, but they were French Mirages. What did the Egyptians have? Brand new Russian MiGs. Right? They had put their lot in with Russia. Didn't work out so well, but they had, you know, as did Syria. So it wasn't as, like, you know, I think of this and I, Vayikach shesh meot rechev bachur v'chor rechev Mitzrayim v'shalishim al kulo, like there's this military buildup going on. Okay? Vayichazak Hashem et lei paro melech Mitzrayim v'yodof achrei b'nei Yisrael b'nei Yisrael yotzim b'yad rama. The Jewish people are going b'yad rama. What does that mean? I don't know either.
Like, imagine them coming out very strong, b'yad rama.
Coming out very strong.
Okay.
The Rashi says gvura. Bigvura gvoha umifursemet. We're going. Hold on. We're going beyond Ramah. Let's go. What second? Let's see in a second. Vayidifu Mitzrayim achroyim vayisigu otam chonim al hayam. Kol sus rechev paro farasha v'chilo. Apia chiro d'ifnei baal tzifon. The Egyptians catch up. Uparo hikriv. Vayisu b'nei Yisrael. So they're going beyond Ramah. Everything is great. Vayisu b'nei Yisrael et enehem. They lift up their eyes. V'hinei Mitzrayim nosei achroyim. What the hell? Okay. Vayiru ma'od. They became very fearful. Vayitzaku b'nei Yisrael el Hashem. They call out to God. And then vayamru el Moshe. Tell me if this sounds familiar. Hamibli ein kvarim b'mitzrayim v'kachtanu lamut b'midbar. Like, see how they're like 5 seconds ago they're Yad Ramah. Let's go. And all of a sudden, shoo! Right, they turn to Moshe and say, "Well, you brought us out here to kill us all." What have you done to us to take us out of Egypt? This is what you said to us.
We said to you,
leave us alone, we'll worship Egypt. Right? The prospect of 67, I think the world was much more like, was in panic in 1967. Because the prospect of, they were, Rav Shtul described it as a second Shoah. Right? That was really the fear. What?
It was terrifying. It was utterly terrifying.
Right.
It looked like the end.
Really?
It looked like the end.
And you hear them and they're saying.
Everybody was ready to come and fight.
I'm so happy you're here to talk about this. No, I really am.
It was astounding, you know.
Well, but they didn't leave.
We were about to get married and my husband was ready to come.
Really? Well, okay, to the fight. But you know, it's so, but I think we don't, this generation doesn't understand that sense of, like, you have to, in order to appreciate the greatness of the event, you first have to appreciate the place where people were at. This is the place where we were at, right? Hamibli in Dvarim b'Mitzrayim, like, wasn't the Shoah bad enough? Now we have to build up this state in order to bring all the Jews together. To do kibbutz galiyot, to give them the chance to destroy the rest of us at one time. That's an agonizing thing. what would have been left of the Jewish people? Really? Could we survive that? I mean, there's always a Kadosh Baruch Hu, who knows? But you know what I'm saying?
Let us have a German need to destroy us in Israel.
Right. Exactly. And that was the great fear, the terrible, terrible fear. And you just don't know. Okay? Vayomer Moshe el ha'am, al tir'u tirau. Don't be afraid. Hityatzvu uru'u et yu'at yeshuat Hashem. God will save us. Stand here. Asher yaseh lechem hayom. Ki asher ri'item et Mitzrayim hayom, lo tosifun lir'otam od ad olam. That which you saw today, you'll never see ever again. Hashem yilachem lechem. God will fight for you, and you shall be quiet. So I have to stop on this pasuk of Hashem Yilachem Lachem as the theme goes on. So we're talking on Friday night about the attack, the surprise air attack that the Israelis attacked the Egyptian Air Force and destroyed the entire Egyptian Air Force on the ground, ending the war, essentially. The war was over before it even started. How did that happen? How is it possible? First of all, we know, as you know, that the Egyptians had just many, many more planes. You know. Secondly, how did they cross the Sinai? It takes time for jets to cross the Sinai Desert. What about the radar?
Weren't they under the radar?
Yeah, they were. No, they didn't travel under radar.
Yeah, there was an article in Mishpacha. There were a whole lot of, like, accidents.
Not accidents. It was the right. So what happened was, so there were three problems that they had to deal with. The first problem was that Egypt had... It had a ground-to-air missile system, an anti-aircraft missile system, from the Russians that was advanced and very dangerous. Israelis were very, very scared about it. Okay, that was problem number one. Secondly, there was an early warning radar station from Jordan that as soon as the Israeli jets would take off, the Jordanians would know about it, and there was, of course, they would agree, and they would tell them, right. The third one is that the Egyptians always had planes in the air. Right, makes sense. There was always four planes, four MiGs in the air, always to make sure, like, you know, that's what you do. That makes sense. So what happened? So the first thing that happened is, it turns out that on that day, that's what they say. I mean, I'm not a historian, so if I'm wrong in the tape, you can tell me. But they say on that day, in that morning, for whatever reason, I think it was the Iraqi foreign minister was visiting. And he was taking a siur. He was taking, you know, there were the Egyptians were showing around about all their military installations. So the Egyptian defense minister, or whatever it was, he was afraid that they would misidentify his plane and shoot him down. So he gave a standing order and he said, you shut off all the radar systems in Egypt. You can only fire on my command only. Nobody fires without my permission. Okay, that's number one.
Because he was flying
over with the Iraqi foreign minister, didn't want anybody shooting him down. Okay. Just so happened that day. Then number two, the Jordanians did see the Israelis taking off. So the guy calls. He calls the Egyptian guy. But for whatever reason, unclear... Right? The call went through. They changed the code name. So he used the code word, whatever it was, you know, pizza. And he kept saying pizza, pizza. The guy's like, I don't know, what do you want? Pizza. And I'm like, doesn't make any sense. Like, they changed the code. The code doesn't mean anything. So he keeps, like, screaming at the guy. And he's like, because they can't say, Israel coming, Israel coming. He couldn't say that. So there was a miscommunication, and the Egyptians didn't get the warning in time. All right, what about the four MiGs? So the four MiGs that were supposed to be up in the air at 7:30 in the morning when the attack happened, it just so happened that there was some big party in Cairo the night before, and the commander of the lead MiG of that four group squadron got drunk the night before and overslept.
I think they also had a Mossad agent inside.
Yeah, Cholio.
They must have.
To get him drunk, to get him whatever. That's all fine and good. All I can tell you is I was listening.
It doesn't work on contingency.
No, it doesn't. I was listening to this discussion. I was listening to this discussion on Friday night, and they were like, "If you heard this, like."
Where did you hear this conversation?
It was Friday night on Erev Shabbat. They were like, some guy had heard a talk from the military. You know, like they're doing all these talks now. So you can look it up. I mean, there's no more explicit Hashem Yilachem Lachem. Yes, you have to actually push the button. You have to do the thing. We're going to see you have to do the thing, but. The notion that they destroyed the Egyptian Air Force on the ground was just like, it was like shooting fish in a barrel. How is that possible? And the answer is, it's not possible.
Right.
And everyone in Israel understood this. Like they immediately understood it. Like they sensed it. They sensed that sense of Yad Hashem. Okay, that's Hashem Yilachem Lachem. Okay, look at the next pasuk. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Mati takelai, Deber b'nei Yisrael v'yisau. Wait, what are you screaming to me for? What do you want from me? It's interesting to me. This is so fascinating to me that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know what to do.
He's not a military leader.
So the reason I think this is fascinating.
He didn't bargain for this. Like when God originally told him to take the Jews out of Mitzrayim, there was no resistance in the discussion.
The reason that this is fascinating to me is when you study the period before 1967, right leading up to the war, there was a period called Abhamtana. The military was building up. They called up the reserve units and everybody was getting ready, but there was this like black gloom over the country. And so Levi Eshkol, like Rav Stuhl spoke about that last night, he said, Levi Eshkol, nice Yehudi, wonderful man, he said he felt the need to get up and speak in front of the country. He said when he got up to speak, hu gimgim, he stuttered, he didn't have the words. And it was just like the perfect expression of the feeling of the country, like, I don't really know what to say. Like, so he got up to give them confidence, and they were like, it made it even worse. Really? You don't know what to say. Who was the Ramatal at the time? Yitzchak Rabin. Rabin famously had a nervous breakdown on the eve of the Six-Day War. Uh-huh. Right. So the whole country is going into war.
Rabin. Like super strong.
That's
brave,
right. Rabin. He had a mental breakdown, famously, on the eve of the war. Why? Like, can you imagine the pressure? What? So we're. Like, and I think about this, and so, like, Moshe Rabbeinu also doesn't know what to do. The leaders don't know what to do. What?
And he also stutters.
And he's also stuttering. So fascinating. Okay. Okay, and you're going to follow. How did it happen, as we know? How did it happen when they went in? According to the Midrash, it didn't happen that way. What happened? Well, that's one midrash. You always think that Nachshon is the one that went in. The midrash says the following. He says, "Vayavo b'nei Yisrael b'toch hayam b'yabasha." The Jewish people went b'toch hayam in the water on the dry land. What was it? Did they go on the water or did they go on the dry land? Says the midrash, "Im b'yam lama b'yabasha." Im b'yabasha lama b'toch hayam. Why does it like? What's the contradiction? Ela mikan. From this we learn. Shelo nikra lahem hayam. The sea did not split. Ad shebo'u letocho ad chotmam. They walked up to their nose. Meaning, we think about it being Nachshon. But it wasn't Nachshon. They said, we're walking. We're going to go. And they started walking. And Moshe lifted up his thing and nothing happened. And they kept walking and walking. And they said, we're going to go. We're either going to drown or God's going to do something. And when it got to here, God said, all right. Open it up. Meaning, it doesn't happen on its own. You have to do your part. Wow. You have to push.
You have to be willing to sacrifice.
Yeah. You have to be willing to put everything on the line in order to make that happen.
Which connects with the seventh day of Pesach and Kiryat Yam Sof and Nachshon.
On that day. Yeah. Okay. One second. Let's look later on. Skip to Dvarim. Now look back. Okay. Dvarim Tet Zayin, Pasuk Aleph. Dvarim Tet Zayin, Pasuk Aleph. Later on, Moshe Rabbeinu goes back and reviews the different chagim. What are the different chagim? Sur, I'll wait for you to find it. Dvarim chapter 16. Okay, it appears, by the way, both, it's interesting, these chagim appear both in Vayikra and in Dvarim. Vayikra Perek Chav Gimbo, and here in Dvarim. Here's what it says, Shamor et Chodesh Aviv, Vasita Pesach LaHashem. Right? Guard, keep the Chodesh Aviv. Ki b'Chodesh Aviv, Otziyacha Hashem Elokecha Mimitzayim Laila. Because in the Chodesh Aviv, okay, HaKadosh Baruch Hu took you out at night. V'Zavachta Pesach LaHashem Tzonu Bakar. You should offer a Korban Pesach. In the place that God will dwell, his place there. You're not allowed to eat chametz, because you ran away from Eretz Mitzrayim. So that you remember the land of Egypt your entire, all the days of your life. Blah, 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 blah. One second. Here, skip the pasuk. Chet. Pasukhe, verse 8. Shesh yamim tochal matzot, ubayom hashvi'i atzeret l'Hashem elokecha, lo ta'aseh melacha. 6 days you eat matzah, and on the seventh day, to the Lord your God, you shouldn't eat matzah. Okay? You shouldn't do melacha, you shouldn't do work. What's missing from this description of Pesach? I skipped a little bit, but what's missing from this Pesach is it doesn't even mention Yom Tov on the first day, right? Chag Rishon is not mentioned. Yes, you bring the Korban Pesach. Never said you couldn't do work on the first day. But it does say, when Moshe Rabbeinu reviews, he says the seventh day. Why does he say the seventh day? So whoever the anonymous author of this year says, because in hindsight, what's the most important day?
The day
we finally were actually really free, right? The most important day isn't when we started the process of being free. The day we finally stood up is the day that we finally ended up being free. That's the day of the holiday because that's the day we finally remember. See, he points out, you have your Tanakh, you're familiar with the beginning of Yehoshua, okay? What happened in Yehoshua? Yehoshua sent messengers. You know, remember he sent spies? Perek Bet, Yeshua Perek Bet. He sent spies to go find out, in Yericho, right? And the spies are coming and they're like looking for them, right? And this innkeeper lady takes them in and she's hiding them in the room and she's like, you got to save me. I know you guys are going to kill us all. How do I know? What does she say? I'm in Perek Bet, Pasuk Tet. Vatomer, Perek Bet, Pasuk Tet. See on verse 9? Vatomer ala anashim. Yadati ki natan Hashem lachem et ha'aretz. I know, right? We know. God gave you this land. V'chi nafla ematchem aleinu. We're afraid of you. V'chi namogu kol yishvei ha'aretz mipnechem. And they're all going to run away from you. Why? Ki shamanu et asher huvish Hashem et me yamsuf mipnechem betzeitchem mitzrayim. What did they hear about? What did everybody know about?
Everyone knew about Yamsuf.
They knew about Yamsuf. They didn't hear about the first day. They heard about the last day. They heard about the military victory. They heard about the destruction of Egypt. They said, whoa, destroying Egypt? That's a strong country. That's a nation. Right? So that when did we really become a force to be dealt with? On Shvi'i Shel Pesach, on the seventh day of Pesach. Let's finish this. We're going to finish this thought with a quote from the Ramban. Go back to Vayikra Perek Chav Gimel. Okay? I'm good timelines, right? This is an important for us to understand what is Yom Yerushalayim and what is it not. Perchav Gimel Pasuk Lamid Vav, he says. Here we are. No, Lamid Vav. Oh, it's Ramban on Lamid Vav. Vayikra Perek Lamid Gimel. On Lamid Vav. Oh, that's not. I brought up a Yikra. Yeah, I kind of need that one. Sorry. No, he says, it's interesting, the Ramban, think about the whole concept of Sefirat HaOmer. In Sefirat HaOmer, what do we have? We have the first day of Pesach, and then the Omer begins, 7 days of Pesach, and then you count 7 weeks, so that's week one, and then you count 7 more weeks, and at the end of the seventh week, what do you have? 6 more weeks, and at the end of the sixth week, you have Shavuot. So you have 7 sevens, okay, where you have week, chag, and then a week, and then you have 7 weeks, where Ramban says the first week is the chag for all 7 weeks.
Ah.
Everybody understand or no? Should I say it again?
Yeah.
Okay.
The weeks are parallel to the days.
Correct.
The first week is equivalent to the first day.
Right.
Correct. Okay, meaning you have chag and then 7 days. So too, in Sefirat HaOmer, you have chag and 7 days. So he quotes the Ramban. Okay. Okay, and that's why it says Atzereti. The name of Shavuot is Atzeret.
Shavuot is like the seventh.
Right. B'tziva b'chaga matzot shivat yamim, and on Pesach is 7 days. B'kdusha lifnehem achrehem, with holiness before and the end. Ki kulam kedoshim. Ubetocham Hashem. All 7 days are really a chag. But according to the Ramban then, Pesach is only the beginning of the larger structure of the entire chag. Why do we become free? We became free to become God's nation. We didn't become what?
To do the mitzvot.
To do the mitzvot. To bring Kishem Hashem Ekra, to be the Am Segula. That can only happen at Har Sinai. But what that then means is that Pesach isn't the end of the process. We did become really free on Pesach.
Even on the seventh day we didn't become
free. Correct. Even on the seventh day we didn't become free. And the seventh day we became the people that could then stand at Har Sinai in order to receive the Torah and to bring God into the world. Where am I going with this?
So then Shavuot kind of represents the Geula?
Absolutely.
Say.
Yom Yerushalayim is not the end. Yom Yerushalayim is the end of the beginning. If Yom Yerushalayim is the day when we became a nation, when the country finally became independent, it got its capital, right? Now, like, they talk about moving the embassy, not moving the embassy, right? Personally, I've decided, I don't care. Why? Because it doesn't matter. When somebody comes, where do they go? Yeah, why? Because that's where everything is. It's not, okay, they'll move the embassy one day, like, whatever. Okay, what do you mean Tel Aviv? Shkoyach. You know what I'm saying? It's like, really? It's not worth the price that we'd have to pay to move it. Because, of course, when you move it, they want something. Like, why should I pay you something that I already have? Why should I pay for something that you know what I'm saying? I don't think that it's worth, and I think that's why BB said, forget it, don't do it. I'm sure he lifted the phone and said, doesn't matter. Because there are other more important things. You know, we tend to focus on these small, on these symbolic things, which are important, but there's a larger picture. So of course he's going to say, no way, Yerushalayim is so important. Everybody knows it's important. But it's important because Mobileye just announced yesterday that they're building a 30-story tower with they're going to have 4,000 tech workers working in Yerushalayim.
Which also means all the satellite programs will be built around there.
Oh my God, that place is going to be huge. It's going to be huge.
Where
and
is it going to impact?
I don't know where it is. I don't remember. Whatever. You know what I'm saying? And think about the businesses that are going to surround there and the people that have to live there and the... You know what I'm saying? And the infrastructure, that's huge. That could have happened without Yom Yerushalayim.
Is it an Israeli firm?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, no, actually, it was bought by Intel. Right, so.
Which is invested in Yerushalayim.
Which paid $15 billion for the price.
It was Israeli.
Mobileye is a company that's working on autonomous cars, which everybody thinks is
cool.
Like, right.
They've already developed the in-car cameras and stuff already.
Right. So Intel bought them for like $16 billion or something. The reason why your taxes sort of went down this year is because that's like a windfall for all of us. Whatever. Okay, but the point though is, if you think about what Yerushalayim is today, right? It was like, I have this great desire, I'm going to go back to the Mandelbaum Gate Museum. Because only, like, you have to go there in order to, like, the dreams that people had just to get to the, couldn't even get to the wall, to stand on the whatever, to see, maybe you could see the Kotel from whatever.
They had like they had like viewing points,
right,
where you could come to, and from here you can.
What kind of capital is that?
Where is the 64?
Mandelbaum, go to search for it. There's a Mandelbaum Gate Museum.
You used to have to sit on you used to have to stand where that movie place is, across the valley.
Yeah.
That's as close as you could get.
Right. How do you have a city like that? How can that be your capital? To today, where they finally built the one around, and the Begin, they finally completed the Begin all the way through, and there's appropriate traffic jams, and there's, you know what I'm saying, and they're building a monorail through the whole city, you know, like the Rakevet Kala into the whole city. It's finally a city, right? So I'll end. Where's the book? Did I bring it? I think the Rav Kamaiti's book. Did I put
it in the kitchen.
Oh, you put it in the kitchen? I put it in the kitchen. I think it. So I'll end with the Fafra of Kermades, but it's a beautiful thought. But like, finally we have a lid. And when you have a heart, then you can build. So Yom Yerushalayim is not the end. It wasn't the day we became free. It was the day we became free in order to reach our goal, in order to move forward. So I think I've showed you this before. I've showed you this book before. This is written by, so I told you, this is Rabbi Dr. Leon Kermades, who was a member of my shul in Connecticut, in Hartford. West Hartford, Dr. Leon Kermades. His father, Rabbi Kalman Kermades, was a rav in Poland, in southwestern Poland, on the border of Germany, in between the years 1928 and 1938, until he was killed by the Nazis. And he wrote essays in the local Jewish paper. He was an avowed Zionist, very, very proud religious Zionist, and wrote essays about that. And so they were celebrating, even back then, they realized the importance of the building of the Yishuv. But he like was very focused on like Tel Aviv was like the heart of the Yishuv, right? That was where the Jews were really building up their presence. And Yerushalayim was this really backwater hick town. Very much so that
it was like Haredi-ville.
It was Haredi-ville, correct. It was really, really Haredi-ville. The Haredim lived there, they only wanted to be there, there was no building up, you know, like they were a little bit in the old city and a little bit in the new city, but there really wasn't a new city. So he was
there was a Chiloni or Masoret.
Yeah, like almost
there was a presence.
It was a presence.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the
poverty stricken.
Yeah, it was Jerusalem. Like it was the old place. It was,
yeah, but
you know what I'm saying? And to a large degree, the Israelis in Tel Aviv, they knew that it was important, but they really, you know, they wanted to build up the new Jewish presence. They didn't want to build up the same old, you know, that was part of the argument about what Israel was going to be. So he writes, in these days of celebration, over the Jewish town of so much promise, i.e. Tel Aviv, my gaze wanders longingly to our broken tablets, to Jerusalem. For just as Tel Aviv represents our whole tablets, with which we confront the world and on which it is written, Judea lives and will continue to live, so Jerusalem, which hides the wreckage of our Jewish holiness, remains the city of our yearning, the city of our Jewish dreams. Your air is life for our Jewish soul, Yehuda Levi wrote. Whoever has experienced you once will carry your landscape, your sun, your sky, eternally in his heart. But who can describe the 1,000 years of sorrow that rests in your peaks? Who can explain the meaning of the quiet, serene wisdom of your valleys? When Mother Rachel arises from her tomb in Jerusalem each night to watch over her children, she sees a curious picture. On the one hand, there are the somewhat too noisy, boisterous children of Tel Aviv. And on the other, the white-bearded, solemn men of Jerusalem, whose faces radiate the brilliance of Kabbalistic secrets, the worldly tumult of the new city, and the majestic stillness of the old. Confused, she turns her glance heavenward to God, who in the Holy Land is so close to man, and her lips bring forth a fervent prayer. Let, O God, the spirit of Tel Aviv and the soul of Jerusalem become one. Let there be a union between the cleverness of Tel Aviv and the radiant wisdom of Jerusalem. The zest of life with solemnity, the thirst for enterprise with the dream, the worldly with the holy. Build, O God, an ark of fire from the old to the new. And together with her, we too pledge, Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim. Only when Jerusalem and Tel Aviv no longer vie with each other, only when the heart of Jerusalem and the head of Tel Aviv have both found a home with the Jewish people, will the broken tablets once again become whole. And only then will Israel once again become the messenger bearing God's tidings at Sinai. Yom Yerushalayim was the beginning. We're moving in that direction. Anybody who has eyes open can see we're moving in that direction. We celebrate Shvi Isha Pesach so we can move towards Har Sinai and Kabbalat Torah. Stop here.